Welcome to Designed for More, brought to you by Common Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. Join Dr. Timothy Jennings, a renowned expert in psychiatry, neuroscience, and spiritual well-being, as he explores the connections between mind, body, spirit, and relationships.
Welcome to Designed for More, sponsored by Common Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. I'm Dr. Tim Jennings, joined today by James Johnson, our chief chaplain here at Honey Lake Clinic, and Dr. Carl Benzio, the chief psychiatric officer here at Honey Lake Clinic. And today we're going to talk about parenting and parenting tips. And this is a big issue, guys. Parenting is critically important to the development of children. So where would you guys like to start? I've got a lot of questions, but I want to just see where you guys want to start.
Where I usually like to start whenever I speak to parents is, well, what's our goal for parenting? You know, and to me, the goal is to raise consistent godly decision makers, to have our kids understand God, know God, and be consistent godly decision makers. So as I teach them various different things, it's to really push towards that goal and help them understand how they can become that themselves so they can role model and then raise up their kids in that kind of with that kind of mindset. And here's that target that we're shooting for.
Yeah, I think that's huge. I spent almost two decades in the education field. And one of the things I would see with parents so many times is they didn't have that clear why behind why they're parenting. And so it resulted in all kinds of problems, like them living through their kids, being helicopter parents, you know, having these weird expectations on their kids because they didn't have that solid why behind the what of their parenting. So I really appreciate you starting with that. It's a good point.
So my, you know, what I've seen, maybe it's because of the population I deal with as a psychiatrist, is that many of the parent problems that many of my patients struggle with happen because not because most of my patients have hearts that want to hurt their children or even neglectful, but they actually don't know the design laws of life. They don't know, they want to do good, and they often intend to do good, but with a good heart, they may take actions that are not actually objectively healthy or beneficial. And so it's often helpful to help them understand the design laws and how things work. And then with that good heart, they can actually make more consistent decisions. That's both internal to themselves, how their minds work and emotion-based versus wisdom-based decision-making that I know you like to talk about, Dr. Carl. And but also the principles of health, physical health, mental health, spiritual health, those types of things. Good heart attitude, and let me put it out to you guys, is good heart attitude, love for someone enough to be a good parent, just to love them.
It's a great place to start, but not enough.
Because I think I kind of summed it, but can you give examples of what you would want some, yes, we want to have a loving heart, but.
Yeah, so, you know, I love my kids. I love my grandkids. I don't want them to be hurt in any way. I want them to experience joy in their life. And they might come to me with a request, as any five-year-old would say, oh, Daddy, I want more ice cream. And so, okay, well, you already had one bowl of ice cream. But because I love you so much, I want you to be healthy. That's enough for tonight. But if I was just concerned with how they feel or that their happiness or that their joy or that they love me back, I would be tempted to give them that second bowl of ice cream or that third bowl of ice cream and not have any boundaries, not have any rules, not have any constrictions from them going out of bounds, doing unhealthy things.
So let's follow up on that, because what you just said is real. You said something very, I think, helpful to our audience because it's a common idea. But I'm gonna ask you a question. You said, you know, I want them to be healthy. I want them to be happy. I want them to have joy. Can they actually arrive at that place if the parent does what you described, no boundaries, no structure? Can they actually arrive at a place where they actually have genuine happiness, joy, and health?
No, there'll be usually a lot more fear, concern, anxiety, because there are no boundaries. There are no protections. And they don't understand how to then be aware of their own limitations, their own needs, their own, where there's danger, where there's not danger, when they're going to be inside the bounds of health and outside the bounds of health or doing things unhealthy. So we need to start to help them understand those guidelines. And that starts with how we interact. First of all, it starts with how we role model our life.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, how we're, you know, obeying our parent, how we're understanding the laws that our parent has designed into us and operating within those and being able to articulate that, you know, in front of our kids. Sometimes we have this stuff going on in our heads that we don't share with our kids. And the kids are like, well, I guess they just magically make decisions. Well, no, we don't magically make decisions. We're not like a slot machine that you put something in and you just pull a lever and a decision pops out. There's a whole lot of machinations that go on, sometimes correct and sometimes incorrectly. So we need to be able to share that more with our kids. But then we want to help our kids understand how to be able to, what is healthy and what is unhealthy. So they can't have joy, peace, contentment, identity, purpose, health, in all those different spaces. You know, we're going to call it health as our general, you know.
But there's physical health, mental health, spiritual health, relational health. Okay, so we're going to unpack this. A couple different avenues. You mentioned something called boundaries. Mm-hmm. If there's no boundaries there, they're not going to be able to have health. Because first, what the boundaries do psychodynamically to the individual and their developing sense of self and why that's true in the anxiety. But then, if no boundaries, will they learn self-management, self-discipline? Will they learn to differentiate the healthy from the unhealthy, the good from the evil? If there's no boundaries, won't they do physiologically and other things like, you know, they'll stay up late, they'll eat junk food, there's no way. And that has a physical impact that stems from the fact there's no good boundaries, but the no good boundaries has a psychological, spiritual impact. Do we want to unpack these things? Yeah.
Well, you know, one of the things that changed for me a lot in life, and hopefully my children will get this from me as well. When I was 16, I think it was the first time I had that aha moment that my parents' rules were not burdens. They weren't things that were keeping me from something. They were protecting me. They were blessings that were protecting me from things. And I started recognizing that the reason why there are places my parents don't want me to go that say, you can't go here, you can't do these things, it wasn't to punish me, it was to protect me. And if we can help our children to understand, parents, that's why we need healthy boundaries, but also to teach our children as they grow up. Like, one of the things that I used to get so frustrated at when I would, you know, my parents never said this, thankfully, that I can remember, but when they would say, you know, because I said so. Well, mom, dad, why can't I do this? Because I said so, because I'm the mom, because I'm the dad. And I feel like that gives us an unhealthy view of authority, and it helps us misunderstand that there's nothing wrong with the maturity if a child is old enough to understand the reason why you hold my hand when we cross the street is because I don't want this car to hit you and hurt you. You know, we can tell them the why behind the what, but that's true of boundaries as well, because if we don't have those healthy boundaries in place and we let children just run around and do whatever they want to, it's going to cause harm.
Mm-hmm. So I want to thank you for both that. I agree with both. One of the things that I have shared with audiences and parents and that might be helpful for our listeners to understand is the emotional benefit of the boundary to the child. If our parents listening remember when your infant was a newborn, how would you get your newborn after they're fed, they're changed, they're not hungry, they're not dirty? How do you get them to settle down, a newborn? You swaddle them. If you don't swaddle them, they will continue to kick and cry until they're, but as soon as they're swaddled, what happens is, and swaddling is a tight wrapping of the infant, they will struggle for a minute and then they'll settle down. And the reason for that is that newborn was recently in a nice, warm, safe, comfortable place where they had the boom, boom, boom of mama's heart. And it was really, and then they've been born into a world that is overwhelming, way more sensory stuff that they can't comprehend, that's frightening, scary. So they're frightened and they're scared. And the swaddling, and they'll struggle, test the boundary. That blanket, it becomes a boundary that reduces the size of the world that they're operating in to one that makes them feel safe. And they will, then I'm safe, now I can go to sleep. And as the child grows a little older, they go from the swaddling to the mother or father's arms who's holding them. As they're grow a little older, it's their presence, okay? And as they grow a little older, it is the rules. And as the parent, the parents set those boundaries, those rules for the child that says you can't go out in the street and play, in the child's emotional world, they don't actually consciously think this, but it feels the street can't come in my yard and harm me. My parents have put a boundary and I'm safe, and thus they don't have anxiety. Only if parents are reliable and predictable. Mm. If the parents are not reliable and predictable, and so I tell them, never set boundaries that you're not going to enforce, then they actually do the opposite. They worsen the anxiety and stress and get more acting out, because what the children are looking for is they're looking for predictability, reliability, stability. And so I give this metaphor, you know, those tile floors that look like a checkerboard.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine you were going to have to walk out on that floor. Some of those tiles are on concrete, hold your weight. Some of those tiles are spun sugar. And if you step on it, you fall through onto spikes. And you have no idea until you step on those, how stressful would it be to try to walk out on that floor? Okay, when parents set boundaries that they don't consistently enforce, the child doesn't learn predictability, reliability. Well, maybe it's safe this time. Maybe I'll fall through this time. Maybe it's okay and I'll get away with it. Maybe I'll get punished this time. And thus it actually teaches the child to have more anxiety and stress. And then they act out more because they're looking for reliability, predictability. When we give them that reliability, predictability, not only do they have less anxiety, they actually are able to eventually internalize that and use those principles in management of themselves. So anyway.
I think that's great analogy of that progression of things. And I think that as kids, parents need to be able to show their kids that they have some power to exercise over their environment to keep them
safe.
So the
kids have power, not the parents have power.
Well,
when you said that, the parents need to show the kids that they have power. Who's the they? Parents or the kids?
The parents.
Okay.
So parents have power.
Okay.
And as a little kid, you know, when there's a lightning storm and you're scared, you want protection. Well, you want to see your parents come that have power, that can soothe you, that can calm you, that can wrap you, that can swaddle you, that can protect you from those external dangers. But if parents haven't exercised in a healthy way those powers, the ability to set boundaries and to set limits and to be able to say no at times, if the kid now has power in that home and has usurped the parents' power, well, when the parents come in the middle of the night, the kid's like, well, you can't do anything. Go back and send somebody else who has power, you know, to help me with this story.
Yeah, yeah.
So now they start looking for other places, whether it's within themselves or to peers or to substances or to other behaviors to try to gain power or mastery. And given their immature brains, given their immature psychological abilities, their lack of understanding of the world, they're not going to be able to execute in those situations very well. And so parents have lost control. Kids want to have confidence in somebody. They don't have confidence here in their parents, and now they're searching other places. I think that's sort of what the battle that parents are fighting in the process, even though they're trying to help their kids. Some of the behaviors that they are putting in play to help their kids aren't really helping their kids. They're just sort of undermining their role as the parent, their role as a model of what God's, you know, who God is in our life and what God can be in our life. And the kids are now looking other places for that control, that power, that safety, those boundaries, those limits, the understanding of who's going to interpret life for me, because my parents really can't interpret life in a healthy way for me.
Now, you both said something that I just kind of have wrestled with over the years with, we had a really interesting conversation. It was not good for me, but good in the long run, I came home one day, and at the time, my girls are homeschooled. My wife is an educator. She homeschools them. And when I came home, when Daddy came home, it was fun time. Mm-hmm. You know, the end of the school day, end of the work day, that was when we could play, we could hang out. But all during the normal day, my wife was the person having to do all this stuff. And it developed into this relationship. She called herself Mama No Fun.
Your wife?
My wife, yeah. And so we had to have this conversation because it was not that the roles were not consistent. You guys, that was the word that came up. The parents need to be consistent, not just in their boundaries, but also in their presence. And we had to say, okay, I was the one that was the one that was like, yeah, let's go do something. And a lot of times that resulted in an inconsistency in the boundaries and the roles. And it started small, right? It started with just coming home from work and being the dad that could play with them. But it evolved into me being the parent who is always the source for, well, if mama says no, let me go to dad.
They do the white hat.
This is really important what you just said. We're giving tips to parents.
Yeah.
So let's spell out the tip.
Right.
Parents are unified.
Yes.
Parents are unified. Children do not get to split. The parent relationship is the husband-wife relationship is a unique bond of unity that as much as you love and would give your life for your children, the children don't get in between that. They never get in between that. Is that not fair to say?
Yeah.
They're not in God's design. They do not come between husband and wife. Husband and wife are to be unified on godly principles now.
Mm-hmm.
On godly principles. that decision making, and so they have equal authority in the home, and that's why the parents have to have agreement on the structure, the discipline, the consequence, the outcome, etc. But because we're human, this is the unified. This is the important piece. Because we're human, it's inevitable one parent will make an error. They'll make a mistake. It's inevitable. We do. It's critically important that the parent who is in the right does not correct the parent who's in error in front of the children and fix the problem. They call the parent into another room, have a conversation, say, hey, you know what? You were about to set, or you disciplined the kids on this and you told them they couldn't go, but you didn't know because you thought they didn't do X, but they actually did, and such and such happened, and you correct them. And the parent who made the mistake corrects themselves. You follow what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. You're unified in that. So I appreciate you bringing that up.
And the follow-up question that's huge is what happens in the mind of the child? I mean, y'all, as psychiatrists, what happens in the mind of a developing child when one parent is one way and the other parent is the other? What does that do for them mentally?
I think to go back a step to that unity element, that doesn't mean that we're necessarily equal or the same. We're clones of each other.
No, right, right.
So we're complementary skill sets.
Yeah,
you know, mother and father in the process. And so,
but equal authority. Yeah,
equal authority, complementary skill sets. And so there's a certain personality that you might have with your kids, and a certain personality your wife. Well, how do we work that complementary? That doesn't mean I have to do the same exact things as my wife, or she has to do things the same exact way as me. We want to enforce certain mm-hmm. boundaries and certain things the same way, but how we carry that out and how we communicate it can be different based on our personalities and our styles. But how do we come into agreement as to, well, how do these things blend together so that we can, you know, present a full team approach to our kids in this unity. And so whenever a kid doesn't get that, and for whatever different reasons, like some that you're describing, that's just a very confusing thing for them to be able to understand. So it's hard for them to see parents as this unity. So whenever they're looking at, well, what's my model of marriage, you know, as they grow up and they're looking at, you know, what is a spouse going to be to them? If they see sort of a fracture, or that's what they're, it might not be that, but that's sort of what they're interpreting from it. And we're sort of reinforcing that interpretation either by deed or by lack of correction of their misunderstanding. Well, then as they grow, whenever they parent, they're going to probably mimic that, unless some intervention happens along the way to remediate them or to help them understand a better way of parenting. They're also going to look at their spouse in a different way and have maybe a different view of marriage based on what their parents presented to them in the process. So what they're forecasting from a relational dynamic in that marriage, and then what they forecast as far as then their peer relationships, their relationships with their siblings, they're going to have trouble with boundaries, with setting limits, with managing their own emotions, with, you know, splitting friends, only looking for friends maybe that are yes people, yeah, but will only do what they want to do.
But why? Why? When you just describe the symptoms or the problem, but why? What's driving that?
Usually people want maximum pleasure, minimal pain.
Yeah, but they're looking for something. They're looking for that security. They're looking for that wholeness. They're looking for, because there's an emptiness or brokenness inside, and they're trying to find that.
That's what I'm saying. They're looking for that pleasure, right? So that pleasure is that.
I see, but not pleasure. And this is why maybe we should clarify the words we mean, because for me, pleasure seeking is just an altered feeling state. Rather than wholeness,
a sense of well-being and health and wholeness.
Yeah.
So to me, pleasure is all those, could be all those good things. It could be very sensual and corrupted view of pleasure, or it could be all those you know, healthy good things that are, you know, the desires of our heart.
I think we're wholeness or healthiness better.
Yeah.
So I would clarify that.
Or that we want to avoid pain. So that confusion, that lack of boundary, that lack of safety. So we're, you know, trying to avoid pain, and we're trying to conserve energy. I want to use the least amount of energy to get those two ends met. And if they aren't provided in a healthy way, well, a 5-year-old, an 8-year-old is going to figure out unhealthy ways to try to make those fixes. Well, they're not going to probably be very good fixes whenever a 3-year-old, a 5-year-old, an 8-year-old is trying to, you know, have that sense of well-being or that sense of safety or that sense of connection, relationship, protection. They're going to try to find other ways to, you know, meet those needs.
So I have often seen, and I'd love to get both y'all's input on this, a common, not exclusive, not total, but a common family pattern is an authoritarian disciplinary father with a merciful pleading for mercy mother. This dynamic. Mm-hmm. Wait till your father gets home.
It's a stereotype, yeah.
Yeah, it's
a lot of houses play out like that.
And I have observed that this often occurs as a reenactment of a distortion about how people see God.
Mm-hmm.
That people see God, the Father, as an authoritarian punisher, and Jesus as our loving mediatorial intercessor who's pleading to the Father his blood so the Father won't harm us. And many families end up functioning like this. But Jesus said, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father.
That's right.
The Father and I are one. God was in the Son, reconciled unto the world to himself. God so loved the world that he gave his only God. God is for us. Who can be against us? That tension does not exist in the Godhead. They're actually united. And thus, I think a healthier approach is that what we talked about a moment ago, united. But I'm just wondering, do you think there's a connection between how the Godhead is sometimes presented and how these roles play out?
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that we even see this in the scriptures, right? Like, here's Abraham, you know, Father Abraham, you know, that he offers his son as a sacrifice. And as we read through that passage in Genesis, we continue through, we see how that encounter shaped Isaac's view of God, that Isaac believed God wanted him dead.
How do you know that?
Well, so when we look at the evidence of what's presented in scripture, we see two really important things. First, we see how from that moment on that Abraham tells the servants, we're going to go up and we're going to come down together. Abraham and Isaac go up, only Abraham comes down. After that moment, Isaac goes and lives in a totally different, he goes to the area where Ishmael lives. And both Sarah and Isaac are never shown in scripture. We can't promise this, but in scripture, we're never seeing them together. That Abraham doesn't, or when Abraham buries Sarah, Isaac doesn't even show up for his own mother's funeral. But what we see that's a really key indicator of this is later on after his son Jacob is born, and when Jacob goes to flee from his uncle Laban, he's got his wives, he's got his flocks, and he's going back to his homeland, that when they have this encounter where his uncle Laban shows up and is like, hey, why'd you run away? He says, I swear by the God of my fathers, Abraham, and the terror of Isaac. It's actually what it says in the Hebrew, that Isaac was terrified of God. And it actually says that twice in that passage, that Jacob refers to his father's God as the terror of Isaac. And so sometimes it translates a little different into the English, but the Hebrew, that's what it says, the terror of Isaac. And it's this idea that Isaac's view of God from how Abraham presented him to him was terrifying. And that's the same thing we can do for our children, that we can present God to them by the way we speak about him, by the way we represent him as his image bearer in the home. And a lot of times, because Jesus referred to God as the Heavenly Father, the Father in the home becomes that archetype in the mind of the child, theologically, spiritually.
Mm.
And so we have to be very mindful. And one of the great solutions to this is found in the scriptures, where God tells the family that in your home, this should be, the command should constantly be on your lips to talk about how good God is, how good his blessings are, that they would put the commands of God on the doorposts of their home. And I know that the Chosen is not a perfect representation of the scriptures by any means, but I love how in the Chosen, you see how when people come in and out of the home, there's the scripture on the doorpost, the mezuzah, and they kiss it.
Mm-hmm.
It's something they honor, something they love. It's not a burden. And so it's because a good parent should walk with their children when they're waking up, when they're lying down, and constantly talking about God
to present him in the healthy. Isn't that Deuteronomy that they were to take the word and they were to teach it to their children as they walked along the way?
Yeah, and rising and you're going and all those things, yeah.
Well, I think that...
And so this is part of the parenting, mm-hmm. To teach our children the word of God. Is that fair?
Well, I think that, you know, my initial goal was that we want to raise good, consistent, godly decision makers, help them know who God is and apply that to their decisions. I think the next step is, I tell parents that they're interpreters or translators of the world to their kids. So kids don't really know how to interpret what's going on around them. And so, like we're talking about, how to raise them up in the Word, because that's the truth. That's the big picture view of what's going on and how to make it micro so that they don't have those misinterpretations of an event in a situation that clouds their view of their father, their view of themselves, and their view of God. And that's our role as parents, that, you know, our kids, they believe in the Easter Bunny, the Tooth Fairy, you know, Santa Claus. They'll believe a whole bunch of lies that Satan wants to put out to them. And so it's our role as parents to, how do we bring the truth into their, into our interactions with them as we're teaching them about the word? Well, how does that word apply to their life? How do these health principles that God's designed into the, how do, you know, why whenever I set a boundary with you, or I don't want you to go out and, you know, as you learned when you were 16, these things are protective for you, instead of just saying, well, because I told you so. We need to be those interpreters or those translators of those situations. Whenever I was in second, we moved around a lot when I was a kid. We moved to a new school in second grade. I'm good in sports. I go out on the playground. I get picked last in dodgeball. It would have been great if a teacher, you know, proctor on the playground come and said, Carl, this is all this means, that today these two kids picked other people on their team before you. That's all that it means. You could be the MVP of the dodgeball game. You could have a lot of fun with new friends. You could come in and crush the spelling test we're going to have after recess. You could trade your chocolate chip cookie for an Oreo and make a new friend. You could go home with your family tonight and have a good dinner, play Frisbee with your dad. You can be invited to these kids' birthday parties on the, you know, in a couple of weeks once they get to know you. All this means today that these two kids picked other people on their team before you. Well, that's not how I interpreted it. I interpreted, well, I'm in a new school. I'm a loser. Nobody likes me. They think I'm awkward. I'm not going to have any friends. We're just going to move again. I was afraid to tell my parents that because they had moved us, and I didn't want them to have more guilt about moving us and me having a bad day on the first day of school. But it would have been nice if somebody would have interpreted or translated that situation for me so that I didn't store all this incorrect data down in my unconscious space to play later about my interpretation of God, my view of my parents, my view of friends, and my view of myself.
So it came to two things. I've got two things I want to say in response to that, because it's really good information. You illustrated some really important points I want to highlight. One, I'm going to do it by an illustrated question, and just to illustrate a point. Can you guys teach me how to build a jet engine, please?
No.
You're talking about teaching. You can't teach what you don't know.
That's right.
And so parents want to teach their children. The first step is that they have to actually come to know something. And if we're going to teach the Bible, they have to spend time in their own personal study to know the Bible and know Jesus Christ. And I think a lot of, maybe I'm wrong, Chaplain, but a lot of Christian families may have done their child's Bible education like we've done our public education. They've let the church do the teaching on Sunday or Sabbath, okay, either day, which they somebody goes, but they're not doing the teaching in the home.
That's right.
And I think the data would suggest that the best outcomes are when the parents first know and the parents teach at home, especially the truth about the Bible.
Teach verbally.
Yes.
And teach indeed.
Yeah, right.
In their behavior. That's what they're actually acting it out.
From the show we did before, the practical neurology. They're actually practicing the principles. That's right. But the other point I wanted to make is that the science has shown that children do best, the children that grow up and do best and have the best resilience, the best success, the best outcomes, they've identified two elements in the home that are integral in their success. And one is a family member confidant, a person within the home that the child can come home from where they didn't get picked and talk about the fear, the anxiety, the bullying on the playground, they said something, all the kids laughed in class. They have somebody they can confide in who then can reprocess and give them that reframe. If a child has that at home, it has a huge difference in their well-being later on. And the second thing is what they call family cohesion, that within the family, the family members have each other's back, that we don't expose each other, we don't embarrass each other, we don't pick on each other, that we stand for each other, we've got each other. Those two elements in a family have been documented to result in much healthier children. Neurobiologically speaking, it's because both of those elements allow the child to turn off their fear circuitry. They learn how to self-soothe and calm. They internalize coping and healthy strategies where they can then face stuff in life, where if they don't get that, then the fears build and the anxiety build and they become more anxious and they see more threats and so forth. So anyway, and you wanted to say something.
Well, just, you know, I appreciate that, because one of the things that I see a lot is where parents do that. that when they have all those great things that you guys just mentioned, and they represent God well, and it's in their life, and it's authentic, and they are connected to a healthy church community, and the kid is involved in youth group, and the kid gives their life to Jesus, and they're doing all these great things, and then they graduate from high school, they move out into the world, and then they start going a different way. They reject the faith, they start living outside of all of these harmonious, even if they learn about God's design laws, and they start living in this rebellious, wait, and the parents will come to me and say, well, I thought the promise of Scripture was, if I raise my child in the way they should go, that's in the Proverbs, right? Then when they're old, they won't depart from it.
That's a mistranslation.
I was going to ask a loaded question. What do we do with that?
That's a mistranslation.
Yeah.
The Bible doesn't actually say to raise a child in the way he should go, and when he's old, to depart from it.
So can we help him with that?
Yeah, it's raise a child. The actual translation is raise a child according to his way. Mm. And when he is old, he will not depart from it. If you allow the child to determine their rearing, decide whether they go to school, don't go to school, stay up, watch TV or do homework, eat junk food or healthy food, let the child determine their rearing, then when they're old, they will be a self-centered narcissist and they won't depart from it. And the Hebrew allows either translation of that. So how do we know which is the right one? Because we have a test case. Perfect, sinless parenting. God parenting Lucifer and the angels in heaven, God parenting Adam and Eve in Eden. A perfect parenting did not prevent going the wrong way. So perfect parenting doesn't prevent because of freedom of will and freedom of choice. And therefore, we know that the promise is not if you do a good job, you're guaranteed a good outcome. It's if you do no job, you're guaranteed a bad outcome because of the way the carnal nature works. If there's not love, there's not discipline speaking in, there is no redeeming forces to counter what the fear and selfishness does in a heart.
So we can give our viewers and our listeners confidence that if you do all the best you can do, and there's no such thing as a perfect parent, but the best you can do, and the child still does that, that's not their fault.
No. So I want to ask you guys if you have any tips for a parent for this. How can a parent discipline, loving discipline, in a way that reduces the likelihood that the child comes to fear the parents in such a way that the child won't come and confide in the parent? We just talked about the family member confidant is critical, but how about if a parent says, but my child won't come to me because they're afraid they're going to get in trouble and then they can't confide in me? What tips do you have to help a parent navigate the element of loving discipline and enhancing the child's willingness to come and talk?
No, that's a great question, and something that all parents run up against in various different ways. And I think it has to be in context. So we have to have a backdrop of what is our relationship interaction with our children. We just don't want to be sort of the policeman that comes in and issues rules in the process. So how do we have that cohesion? How do we have that relationship? They try to figure out, well, what is quality time? Well, quality time comes from quantity of time. So you have to have quantity of time with your kids. And what is that time filled with? About questions, about interactions, about sharing your life with them, them sharing their life with you, by you being inquisitive and asking them about their thoughts and their feeling and how their day went. And so they see that you have a genuine interest in them and their well-being. And then as you set up your guidelines for life and how they're going to manage themselves with various boundaries, because I love you, because I care for you, I want the best for you, and whatever that looks like in that particular situation or success, so to speak, healthy living, joy, peace, attention, all those positive elements that persons are. Well, here's the boundary. Here's what's going to be helpful. Here's what's going to be protective. That if you do these things, you're going to walk in fullness and health and wellness and success and flourishing, however your family's culture and terms are going to be for that. But if you don't, I need to help you understand that this is the way that is most beneficial for you. I'm going to try to set guardrails for you or have some consequences for you to learn and understand this, because I don't want you to go through hurt that's on this side of that fence, that's on that side of the boundary in that yard or whatever term that you want to use. And so being able to set it up in a way that I love you, I care for you, I want the best for you, and I want to keep you from harm, even though it might look tempting, it might look like it's beneficial, it might look like it's going to promise all these different things, it really isn't. you know, and help them understand. Now, some kids get that the first time that you put it out there, some don't, but then whenever you're able to come back to it and say, hey, remember we had that conversation and we talked about what was healthy and what was unhealthy, and you see some of the ramifications of whenever you went astray, how it affected you psychologically, emotionally, your trust in us was broken, you were reticent to come to talk to me, to share with me. So we need to put it out there. They might not follow it, but we can always come back to it. And now it starts to make more sense. Just like when we read a Bible passage, the first time we read it, do we get all the depth of it? No. But we live life a little bit, then we come back to it, we get a little bit more out of it. We come back to it, we get even more out of it. And so the parent to put it out there, even though they think their kid, well, they're not going to understand it, they're not going to obey it, they're not going to be able to live that way. But yeah, but it's an important conversation to have so that you can reference it and draw on it, whether it's making your bed, putting your books away, you know, not hitting your sister, you know, whatever the particular infractions are that you're trying to curb, putting it into that kind of context for me and with our kids and patients I work with seems to help them, and being able to get that across and not feel afraid that we're going to lose that relationship by setting limits with them.
And one of the things that you mentioned that I think is really key is, you know, I just want to hit home on it, as you said, that quality time is also quantity of time. I don't know how many times I've seen in a family relationship with the parents, for sometimes the best of reasons, working to provide extra things. And mom and dad are working all the time. They're involved in church, right? They're in all the Sunday schools and the revivals, and they're, you know, traveling on trips. They've got all these wonderful people they're ministering to. There are all these great things in the community, but they're not present in their children's life with quantity. And what ends up happening is when the child breaks a rule and they get in trouble, mom and dad show up. That, oh, they're there for the discipline, but they're not there for the other things. And the child can learn this unhealthy relationship to where if I want mom and dad's attention, I got to get in trouble. And maybe they don't always even make that conscious decision, I'm going to get in trouble. Sometimes they do.
Or they learn that mom and dad
are unified.
Or they learn that I can't really talk to them because they're the ones who bring the hammer down.
Right.
Because they don't have the quality of all those other experiences that as a foundation. So I think that's a good point. You've got, and I think both of you described that, you've got to have that loving connection in all the positives. And then when you do the discipline, it's under that umbrella, because I love you. And when there's calm and you can have a conversation as to why the consequences and the design laws and educate them and so forth. But I want to share with parents something that I think is really important, because I don't think it's necessarily obvious, but I tell them never set boundaries, discipline boundaries that you're not willing to enforce, because what you teach your child, if you don't enforce them, is that they can't trust you. That's the thing. And I give this example. If you told your child, if they studied really hard and made 100% on their spelling bee this week, you'll give them $5. And they studied really hard and they come home 100% and you don't give them the $5, what did you just teach them? You taught them that you don't keep your word and you can't be trusted.
That's right.
Now, if you say, if you don't pick your toys up before dinner, you can't have ice cream, can't have dessert with the rest of us. Dinner comes, the toys are all over the thing, and you give ice cream to everyone but that child, and that child begins to wail and cry and get upset, and you say, okay, you can have ice cream this time, but next time pick up your toys. What did you just teach him? That you're a liar, you don't keep your word, and you can't be trusted.
That's right.
The issues about the boundaries are more than just disciplining the child's behavior. It is about your reliability, your consistency, which provides a home where safety and predictability exist. And so it's critically important. Think carefully when you set a rule with a child, because it may very well be tested. And it isn't really about the toys. It is about, can I trust mommy, daddy?
And a lot of them will be tested, and we want them to test to some extent,
right? Yes.
We want them to ask us and come to us. But if we're not trustworthy to give reliable information or to be consistent in that process or to help them navigate or to be able to interpret reality for them in a healthy way, they're going to start to, again, reject us and go to other sources, you know, for that appeasement, for that joy, for that pleasure, to get correction, to get understanding, somebody else that they think that they can trust instead of us in that process.
So we've talked so far about quantity and quality of time, healthy boundaries, teaching God's word, Did I miss one of the points?
I would say we touched it a little bit is emotion management. So, you know,
talk about that. And emotion management for the parent first, or teaching the child emotion management? Unpack that for us.
Yeah, that's great. So, you know, to me, I often think that I have two volume buttons in my head, an emotional volume button and a thinking volume button. And only Jesus can have them both cranked at the same time. So if our emotional volume is high, our thinking volume is low. And that's why players choke, because their emotional volume is high, so they're not able to think. Or people forget their lines in a play. Their emotional volume is high, so they're not able to think and remember their lines. So as parents, whenever our kids are doing something that increases our emotional volume, it makes it hard for us to think. So our word choice, our demeanor, our expression, our body language, the infractions. Sometimes whenever I got angry with my kids, I'd say, wow, I'm so angry right now. I'd give you the death sentence for that, you know, that thing that you did. But I know that that's the wrong thing to do. I'm going to take a time out. I'm going to calm down. And whenever I'm thinking more clearly and my emotional volume is down, we're going to sit down, talk about what you did, and figure out what a good appropriate consequence for that situation is. So as parents, we want to be able to soothe and have radar for where is our emotional volume. When we're getting that 3, 4, 5-ish, we're probably starting to think a little bit fuzzy, and certainly 7, 8, 9. And kids know how to push our buttons so that we'll give in a situation, and we'll give them that ice cream, even though we said, here's what that boundary is, or here's what that consequence would be, or you don't get this reward. So they know how to push buttons to get our emotions to override command central so that we're not thinking. With our kids, it's the same way. When our kids' emotional volume increases, they're not going to be good decision makers. So we want to be able to help them understand their emotions, be able to start to soothe. What are those soothing things? What are those biblical concepts? What are hymns? What are passages from scripture? What is being able to count to five? Whatever's maybe having a timeout so that you can, you know, your child can calm down. So we're not giving a timeout to punish them necessarily, but to, hey, we want you to be able to start to soothe, start to calm down. Whether it's giving them a gentle hug, there can be just a bunch of different things that allow them to calm and soothe so they don't be an emotional decision maker. Now we can start to then, okay, this is why you don't steal cookies from the cookie jar, or you don't hit your sister, or whatever. And so I think with parents, that's a hard thing to manage, because our emotions are our warning system. So we want our kids to have feelings. So whenever your kid is angry, you want them to come to you and say, Daddy, I'm really angry. And when my daughters would come to me and say that, I'd say, that's great. So I'm glad your warning system is working, and you trust me to share what you're getting warned about. Now let's sit down and figure out how to soothe and figure out, well, what are you getting warned about?
Yeah, but I want to unpack this idea of helping the child learn to manage emotions. These are what timeouts are for. Okay. The timeout that the parent will enforce, The parent is not actually calming the child. The child is learning to hold themselves in a corner, or my mother, sit on your bed, and you can't get off your bed for 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. Now, 5 minutes is not very long, but for a child, it feels like a long time. Mm-hmm. Okay. And when my mother would do that, I would go, I'd make some grumble. That's 10 minutes.
Right.
That's 15 minutes. You want to try for 20? Okay. And why shut up? I stopped talking. I had to do that. Okay. And then I would have to sit there for those minutes. And I, during those minutes, would calm down some. Okay. Uh-huh. But I had to learn that self-restraint, right? And that's neurobiological. So putting kids in timeout is not abuse. Mm-hmm. It's holding them accountable, adding the pressure on 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes. This is not parents need to do this, or it's the kids. When a child says, if you don't let me have some candy, I'm going to hold my breath. I'm going to, well, you have a piece of candy. Don't hold your breath. That's destructive to a child. Rewards bad behavior. Tells them they don't have to learn self-management skills. And so setting healthy boundaries, allowing the child to have a tantrum. Okay, you have it. Mm-hmm. When you have those tantrums, you then after you go to your room for 15 minutes or whatever it is until you can be calm and come back out. That is healthy parenting. Now, you can't let the child's tantrum control the environment.
But yeah. What about when the tantrum's in the middle of the store?
Yeah.
Let it play out. Yeah. Or you take the kid and
you have to leave the store.
And sometimes you leave the shopping cart. And you just go to the car and take the kid to the car. Sometimes, you know, you just let it play out depending on how intense it is. Because they're, like we talked about, they're testing. They're going to see, are you going to give in or not?
The general rule of discipline, remember we're talking discipline, is the consequence needs to be more distressing for the child than the parent. In other words, if you leave the store and leaving the store actually causes you great inconvenience because you really need to get some things. You're going to have to come back, and it's going to cost you an hour and a half to come back to do it. And it's going to inconvenience way more than the child. That is not the right answer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the consequence needs to cause the child to look back and go, that really inconvenienced me more than the other person. Because it's oftentimes these types of behavioral outbursts are designed to manipulate the person and teach the parent, see, don't do that to me next time. Because, and the parent, if they're not really thoughtful, like, you know what, it's just not worth it. I had to have an extra hour. I have to drive back to the store. I'll just let it go this time. Mm-hmm. And see, there's a conditioning that's going on here. And
well, there's a transfer of power.
Yes.
Right, we talked about earlier,
right.
You know, the power.
Right. And so the general principle is whatever the misbehavior, the child needs to reap a consequence that they regret more than the parent regrets. Does that make sense?
It's just to some extent, you know, depending on their age, as they get older, then they can discern what's more regrettable to the parent. And for a three-year-old, doesn't usually know, well, what's more regret for the parent in that particular situation.
Yeah, but it's still the same principle. We do this in a psychiatric ward when a patient acts out. The doctor or the therapist is, you know, I'm really, you know, my heart is sad for you. I wanted you to be able to have this weekend pass, or mm-hmm. I wanted you to be, and I'm really sad that you did. I'm personally not hurt by what you've done. I'm sad for you that you've done this. So this can be done with your children too. That we're sad that you lost. Yeah, I wanted you to go to that banquet at your school this weekend, but you know, you decided to smoke marijuana, and so there's a consequence to that. Okay, that type of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And you said something that was helpful to me. I didn't know how to put it in those words at the time. That when our children were younger, and I'm in the store, and the kids are throwing a tantrum, you know, for whatever they, I wanted this, and you said no. Well, that emotional volume started going up, and I was like, I want to get out of this. I'm embarrassed.
Right.
The kids are throwing a temper tantrum. Let's get out of here. And I, you know, but then as the emotional volume came down and the thinking went up, I was able to say, children have tantrums in every family. You know, I've seen this before. There are parents that are going to laugh because they remember when their kids were that little. The store's not going to kick me out. I'm not going to get punished by the manager. Okay, so let's check out, and then we can talk about it when we get in the car. And that's when the discipline. I didn't want to, like you said, I'm going to have to come back to the store. I've got a grocery cart full of groceries, and I wanted to give in because I was embarrassed and I was thinking emotionally. But when the emotional volume went down and the thinking volume went up, I could bring reality.
Thank you for that. What you just pointed out, you said I was embarrassed. In other words,
that's the word I was going to pull out too.
In other words, your child's behavior, you were tempted to respond related to self,
mm-hmm.
how it's making me feel or me look, and that then leads to the emotion. But when you shifted to, hey, what's good for my child?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you know what? And reality based, it's not the big deal. The parents may laugh. It's not about me. It's about me doing best for my child. Things calm down. And I think it's a big principle. One of the things that may jack the emotions up is when they do something that touches on ourself and threatens our power or threatens our sense of security, then we may react with authority or control. And that's where that love piece coming back and saying, wait, what's best for my child here?
And would you say that's connected to the parents that want to be like the friends of their kids? Like, I want to be liked by my kids. So when they do this, I want to keep that relationship where they're, you know, they still act like they love me because I'm going to keep feeding into that.
So parents, any parent who has that attitude will be a bad parent. I'm just going to say straight out.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to take a very kind of, extreme, maybe you might say position, but you can't.
Hard and fast.
Yes. If you are looking for your sense of well-being and validation to be given to you by your child liking you, you will fail to do what your child needs. You are not there to get your child's approval. You are there to provide your child what they need. And if you're providing what they need, I can guarantee you there will absolutely be times when your child in that moment will not approve.
So when a teenager is saying things like, oh, you're the worst, you're terrible. I was going to go that far. But yeah, you're right. You know, that doesn't mean when I'm enforcing the boundary, that actually means I'm a good parent.
That means you're doing a good job. I had one father who came to me many, many years ago whose home was chaos. And here's how he would discipline his son. You won't be mad at daddy if daddy puts you in time out, will you? And if the child was, then he would do something else. Okay. So you cannot parent that way.
Well, again, that's giving up power.
Yeah, exactly.
And now the kid has the power.
Yes, exactly.
And the parent, so because the kid's not going to look to the parent for anything because, well, that parent has no power. They have no ability. And whenever I'm in distress or I'm having a problem, they have no power to remedy it. So I need to look other places.
Right. So the parent is not there to be the friend. The parent is there to be the parent, a loving parent that does what's well. And if you do that, your children will grow up to love you and you will have adult friendships with your children. But if you do the other thing, they will grow up and have no respect for you at all.
Well, I think when you're trying to be a friend to your child, the premise is that my child is always going to make a healthy, functional request of me.
Yeah.
Right. Well, no kids are going to have 100% healthy functional requests.
Right.
Right. So they're going to have dysfunctional requests at various times. So as a parent, if I want to be their friend, then I'll give in to their dysfunctional requests. But if I'm going to do the healthy thing, the right thing to honor God in the process and do the best for them, well, I'm not going to honor their dysfunctional requests. I'm going to give them what.
But there's even more friendship. If it's a true friendship, as far as human relationships go, there's equal power and equal authority. But in a parent-child relationship, there's actually a power dynamic that's not equal. So you really functionally can't be.
Correct.
And it actually sows confusion into their understanding of how relationships work even. So there needs to be truth in one's own mind about who they are and what their responsibilities are. And what are parents responsible for? Parents are responsible for the decisions they make in governance of themselves. They are not responsible for how their children turn out.
That's right. That's good. They have significant influence,
but not responsibility.
But no control.
As in, again, God and Lucifer, God and Adam and Eve, that they didn't turn out because God wanted those beings to go into rebellion. That was not, or that he caused them to, or he parented them badly. No, God was responsible for his perfection in his parenting and all that he did, but not for the choices they made. But yes, correct.
So we want to use our influence wisely.
Yes.
Then, I mean, I want my daughter to love me. I could get her a brand new car. And one daughter could say, Daddy, you're the greatest. I love you. The other one could say, is that it? My best friend across the street, she got even a better car than that. She doesn't love it. So we don't have any control over their emotions and what they can do. We have some influence, so we want to be good stewards of that influence God has given us in our child's lives, but we can't control the outcomes.
Thank you for joining us today. We hope these tips were helpful for you. If you have questions, send those in to designformore.net.
Thank you for joining us on Designed for More, brought to you by Come and Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. Also, don't forget to check out our other podcasts for more inspiring content.